Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our March 1st service. Joseph Benarek's sermon title is Reading Obituaries During Morning Coffee. The music following the sermon is Spudiskeri, a traditional folk song from the Shetland Islands performed by Ida Domaslicki and Cora Weiss Moore. Thanks for listening.
The reading this morning is a beautiful poem by an American poet named Dan Gerber. Dan has attended here and spoken to Quimper Unitarian a couple of different times. He's a very powerful presence in the American poetry universe, and this poem is called Postscript. I think I may have startled you signing this letter with love at the end, that you may think I'm being too familiar, sending the wrong signal, that we don't know each other that well, that there's so much about you that I'd find unlovable if I really knew the real you, that I've overstepped, invaded your space, I may want you to love me, that this could complicate our lives impossibly, that among people, I think of my father telling me an hour before he died how he thought of all the men and women he'd loved and how he wished he told them when he could have. So on this lovely Sunday morning, I would like to alert everybody gathered here in this welcoming sanctuary that this sermon beams light on obituaries and, by necessity, death. And also, if you choose to allow your mind to drift in that direction, your impending death and your future obituary. Now, if you're uncomfortable with death, and especially with your yet-to-be-composed overview describing your life, then please be advised that this sermon may induce symptoms that include, but are not limited to, prickly flesh, cold sweats, hollowed-out stomach, shallow breathing, spikes in blood pressure, vertigo, headaches, backaches, rashes, insomnia, and an insatiable desire to eat your preferred comfort foods, ranging from ice cream and macaroni and cheese to heaping spoonfuls of peanut butter and macaroons. Thoughts of death can do this to people. We all get it. And then, the objective fact that you are currently very much not dead may inspire you to smile at the sun, plant tomato starts, open that good bottle of wine you've been saving, call your grandchildren, nod and smile at the harried cashier, give 10 bucks to the guitar player along the sidewalk, because death, frankly, is more common than foot fungus, and we're reminded of this fact because of the steady stream of obituaries published by the millions every year. In researching for this sermon, I discovered that in the United States, a person dies every 12 seconds, which means that I don't even want to do the math to figure out how many people will die during our time together this morning, though I know that a few of the humanists in the room have already calculated it out. Okay, one every 12 seconds is 5 each minute times 60 minutes. 300. Interesting. 300. 300 concrete personal subjects for obituaries during this hour alone. Now, whenever I receive a business-sized envelope from my mother, my first thought always is, who died? Because my mother reads the local obituaries every morning over coffee, and she provides that invaluable service of clipping noteworthy obits from the Post Journal and sending them to the relevant parties of me, my brother, and or my sister. I could fill a small scrapbook with these clipped obits that she sent me over the years, and I probably should. Mrs. Geisler, Mr. Geisler, Mr. Alessi, Mrs. Stewart, both Mr. and Mrs. Arnone, though they died a few years apart. Now I dutifully read these clippings in my mother's note, usually quite short, in her very neat script, such as, Mrs. Geisler died last Thursday. She was a nice lady. Love, Mom. And then reflect upon my connection with the deceased and consider a donation to whatever cause or organization concludes the obit. In lieu of flowers, please send a donation to the Cancer Society, St. Luke's Catholic Church, or a charity of your choice. Now, much is communicated about the deceased in those closing requests for donations, and I always read them with interest. Then, with the obituary staring me in the face, I sit at my kitchen table, one of my holy places, and I draft a condolence card to my friend. These drafts are always on scrap paper, always using a pencil, never a pen. These condolence cards take some thinking, some consideration, because I want to move beyond the obligatory, I'm sorry for your loss, and approach some of the specific and personal reasons for sorrow. Dear Jim, I am so sad to hear about your mom's passing, and I'm sorry for your loss. Your mom was a very special person and a huge presence in my childhood on Chautauqua Avenue. My favorite memory, which is actually a decades-long collection of memories, is that every time I came into your house, there seemed to be a big pot of spaghetti sauce burbling on the stove. And I loved how your mom called it spaghetti. I never thought about that when I was a kid, because that was just the landscape of my childhood, burbling pots and strange pronunciations. But now, it means everything. Here was a mother, your mother, always cooking, stirring, tasting, adjusting a big pot of sauce to feed her family through their growing up. Steam billowing up from the pot, the kitchen smelling like life itself. I never told you this before, but I took special joy entering your family's kitchen. It was so moist and so alive. I practiced this sermon yesterday morning in my kitchen, and it is just a killer for me. I apologize. But man, oh man. I always entered your house through the back hallway with that screechy screen door, which led directly into the aromatic, burbling nirvana of your family's kitchen. Now, looking back from adulthood, I realize now that your mother must have sliced and diced 10 million tomatoes and onions and mushrooms and peppers and basil and hot sausage. And for that, I bow in honor to my wife's garden and our own collection of pots and pans. Please know that every time I eat spaghetti, I think spaghetti. And every time I smell the aroma of tomato sauce, it never comes close to the smells forever swirling inside your mother's kitchen. It turns out, one place where your mother's memory lives is inside of me. Tonight, I shall eat a mountainous plate of spaghetti with the best tomato sauce that I can make, knowing that it will never be as close to your mom's. No sauce ever will in this lifetime. Your friend, Joseph. Now, when thinking back to that note, I wished I'd signed it love rather than your friend. Again, the concluding stanza of this morning's poem, Postscript, from Dan Gerber. Among people, I think of my father telling me an hour before he died how he thought of all the men and women he'd loved and how he'd wished he'd told them when he could have. Now, Mrs. Arnone's published obituary in the Post Journal did not mention her tomato sauce, did not mention spaghetti, or her impact on a neighbor boy who felt welcome entering her steaming kitchen in search of his friend. Her published obituary, truth be told, was as standard and as dry as they come. Place of birth, cause of death, where she worked, family details, no delicious tomato sauce anywhere. It was as if a boring form, which had been mimeographed 300 times an hour, was handed to the grieving family to fill out in that time-pressed, cold fog. I wished who had ever written that obituary had followed a few of the simple rules posted online, the how to write an unforgettable obituary. One, start with a story. What was the moment that defined what kind of person they were? Begin with a few sentences telling that story. That's how you capture people's hearts. Two, tell where they grew up and why it mattered. Everyone's life has a beginning. Who raised them, where, how did their early days point towards what was to follow? Three, tell what they loved, what got them excited, a hobby, a cause, an accomplishment, or an appreciation. What did they talk about most? Faith, music, work, charity, family life? Share whatever that is and that what they would be eager to tell someone about. Four, tell whom they loved. Almost everyone has someone in their life sometime who meant the world to them. Whether it's a spouse, children, parents, a best friend, a dear teacher, take a few words and remember the relationships that were most important to them and why. And five, tell what you'll remember most about them. It can be both sad and joyful to think about what we'll miss after our loved ones die. Putting it into words keeps them closer to us in spirit, and it brings us all who remember them closer together in love. Sound guidance, to be sure. Though if I had my druthers, every obituary questionnaire would have extra credit questions that prompted even more colorful considerations to move beyond the obvious and the sentimental, to encourage the imagination to slip behind the curtain of polite society. What secret vices did the deceased possess? When did the deceased laugh like a donkey? What did the deceased hide under their bed? What secret vices did the deceased possess? Margaret enjoyed shoplifting penny candy from the drugstore and then giving it to her grandchildren while telling morality tales about how sweet the virtue of honesty was. The kids thought her smile was reflecting their delight when, in fact, it was slyly welcoming them into the complicated mysteries of being human. When did the deceased laugh like a donkey? Well, John's laugh actually sounded like a maniacal hyena, and it took some getting used to. He once peed his pants while laughing at Archie Bunker and All in the Family. That said, he also wept when the Buffalo Bills lost their first Super Bowl. He actually curled into a fetal position in the living room floor and cried like a baby. His wife was so disgusted with his behavior over the fate of a sports team that she impulsively left to visit her sister for a week. During that week, without his wife, John cleaned out the garage and discovered that mice had eaten the tastier parts of his high school letterman's jacket. What did the deceased hide under the bed? Sally didn't hide anything under the bed, though she had a decades-long obsession with frog figurines. At the time of her death, she owned over 2,000, each unique. The largest was the size of a small rhinoceros that she kept in the den as a conversation starter. Every flat surface in her home had multiple frogs displayed on it. While everyone thought she should tone it down a bit, they appreciated knowing what gift to get her for any and all holidays. The frogs will be sold at her estate sale to raise money for the local watershed restoration action group. Now that would make so much better reading, right? Now when thinking about obituaries worth reading. The New York Times obituary pages can be held up as the gold standard, as the nation's so-called paper of record. Getting an obituary in the New York Times is significant, and they publish only about 1,000 a year, so the obituaries in any given year are among the 55 million people who die worldwide every year. And so along with the daily publication of obituaries in the New York Times, there are actually anthologies of their obituaries, comprehensive indices, and even a documentary film about the obit department. In the introduction to the book, the anthology, The Obits, the editor of the obituary section writes, quote, "Once our decisions are made, the writers take over. Most people refer to any newspaper article as a story, but probably none deserves that description more than an obituary. These are life stories, after all, told with the urgency of journalism and the sweep of biography. They have beginnings, and unlike most newspaper stories, endings. They carry news, certainly, the fact of death, but once that has been reported, usually in the first paragraph, very little, if anything, is said about it from then on. It's the life we're interested in, and distilling it into 600, 900, or 2,000 words is something of an art." Now, 600, 900, or 2,000 words to tell the story artfully, and with a respectful bow to the exclusive club of those whose obituaries are published in the New York Times, every human life is important, n'est-ce pas? Mother, father, son, daughter, brother, sister, aunt, uncle, cousin, neighbor, friend, colleague. Though my Uncle Frank, who wasn't really an uncle per se, some sort of step relation to my maternal grandfather who may or may not have been married, who lived alone, died in his small rental apartment in Indiana, and wasn't found for days because nobody detected that he was gone. Every human is important to someone, though no one detected Uncle Frank was gone for days. I didn't attend his funeral, if ever there was one. I don't know where he's buried, and I never read his obituary, and I didn't bother looking in the indices of the New York Times. So, with this new invention called the internet, I searched for Frank Grome and found an obituary for a man called Frank Grome Jr., who died a few months ago. Frank Grome Jr.'s obituary was published in the Chicago Tribune, and it flashed some style with the invitation at the close. "We would like to celebrate Frankie's life as he lived with a beer or cocktail of your choice at the American Legion." In an uncommon reverse flow of my mother's newspaper clippings, while writing this sermon, I sent her an email with a link to the obituary for Frank Grome and this question: "Is this the son of Uncle Frank, Grandpa's relative who used to visit us?" Now, if I had discovered a family death before my mother, I would have been astonished. And the response was swift and definitive. Quote, "The obit you found doesn't belong to our Grome clan." I love when people use the word clan. She continued, "And Uncle Frank's last name was Buh, B-U-H, not Grome. I stand before you humbled that I did not even know Uncle Frank's last name." Now, I would fathom a guess that at one point over the past decade, we have all read at least one obituary from beginning to end of a person we did not personally know, and we came away from that obituary deeply inspired. I love that community activity. As Unitarian Universalists, we hold as foundational a principle that every human life is inherently worthy and infused with dignity. Now, I would like to take the bold step to suggest that we also consider every life inherently interesting and thus worthy of our attention. And not only after a person dies and their story gets distilled, but before they die, when they can show off their frog collections, and we can take a peek to see what they in fact hide under their bed. And here we have arrived at the proverbial crust of the biscuit. Read the obituaries to honor the dead, then become inspired to live ever deeper among the living. Among the living, where your religion thrives, because dead people practice no religion. Carry the basic prompts of a good obituary out into the field and ask your friends and family, what's your story? Where'd you grow up? What do you love? Who do you love? Listen close and then offer this. Now let me tell you what I love about you. Now let me tell you what I love about you. And with this, we have just invented a new genre of writing called probituary. Being inspired by our living among the inherently interesting to proactively tell them in real time why you care about them. To reflect back to them your appreciation for their interesting life, the one that they are currently engaged in. In this way, through storytelling and listening and appreciation, we will create more nuanced relationships, stronger communities, and our lives will become richer for the practice. So, when we do read their obituary, we can say, I knew Mrs. Arnone. That woman could make some tasty sauce. Amen.